So algorithms are a hip new thing nowadays. Vicky's really excited about this. This is how we get relevant. But it's true. So algorithm's a funny word, and one of the reasons why it's funny, it comes from the name of a 9th century Persian mathematician, actually. Al-Khwarizmi, and so it kind of anglicized into algorithm. But it's basically a self-contained sequence of actions. But it first kind of birthed a lot with Google. That's the reason why Google became Google, was its algorithm was a lot tighter. And so you could search. If you remember back to 2003, when Google was first starting out, and you're like, you have Alta Vista and Yahoo and all these things, and you have no idea. And then it's like, oh, ba-da-roop, it gets you exactly what you want. But algorithms can be used in a lot of ways. And so they're very old, but because of computers nowadays, you can process a ton of information. And a lot of industries use algorithms as predictive models. And so, for instance, you can look back. One of those is law enforcement. And so you can look back over the last 100 years and see every single robbery that's taken place in the community, and use that and process that with an algorithm as a predictive measure to see when in the future something like that is going to happen. So that's mostly what it's used in law enforcement. It's used for these street crimes. It's used in this way to predict, okay, when it's going to happen, and then supervisors can move their personnel around. So like, okay, this is a high impact area, and we have the evidence for it, so we're going to move personnel for that. So recently, I've seen this wonderful app called the White Collar Crime Risk Zone, and it uses the same algorithms for white collar crimes, for financial malfeasance. And what they did is taken data from 1964 to the present day of every incident of financial malfeasance, of bank fraud and other things like that, and where those locations happen, and use that to model on the block level. Now, as you can imagine, if you are looking at street crimes and other things like that, it would be in certain areas of the city. So I have a few maps to show where. This is Austin in the with the white collar crime. And as you can see, it's mostly downtown or like going off of 360. And so those are the places of predictive zones. All right, now next we'll do Dallas. And so this is, you see, North Dallas is the issue. These are the areas where white collar crimes have taken place. And then the easiest one is in Manhattan, which is the last picture. And you can see it's like it's all downtown and midtown, with like finding like a few things in Jersey City, which is interesting. But it's like, Queens and Brooklyn is almost empty with those kind of issues. I like this as an example because it makes us like rethink. When we think of crime immediately, usually it's that person-to-person contact. Usually it's that person. It's like someone stealing your car, someone doing this, someone who robbed you, and that's, you know. And we have this image sometimes of that's what crime is. That's what justice should be about, and that's not especially. But I want us to broaden our assumptions of that. Broaden our assumptions of what we expect justice, what we expect to be protected from, what we expect order in our society to be. Sometimes when we think about the Ten Commandments, it's easy to focus on, okay, the you shall not steal, you shall not lie, you shall not murder. And those ones are really easy to put into laws. But the Old Testament is much broader in what justice looks like. It has a lot to say, actually, about white-collar crimes in the Old Testament. I don't know if you all realize that. One of those is changing scales, is not having good scales, and so putting weights on the scales. In Leviticus, it describes, you shall do no wrong in judgment, in measures or lengths. If you have a faulty scale, or you have something that says it's a meter, but it's actually less than that, it's a way to cheat someone you're dealing with. It's like, do not do this. You shall have just balances, just weights, and a just ephah. I am the Lord your God. It also says in Deuteronomy, you shall not have in your bag two kinds of weights, a large and a small. You shall not, if you see someone coming, and be like, okay, that's a rich person. I'm going to give them the big, like the heavy weights. Oh, that's not as much, but I just want to milk them for what they got. It's like, no, you shall not have that. You shall not have a house of two kinds of measures, large and small, a full and fair weight. You shall have for everyone. For all that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God has given you. For all who do such things, who have multiple measures, all who act dishonestly are an abomination to the Lord. Doesn't mince words about this. And then we get to the fun passage, which is usury. The Bible doesn't have a lot of nice things to say about usury. This is one of those passages, those readings of the Old Testament that we as a modern society have completely separated from. That usury nowadays is used to refer to onerous interest and onerous loans. And the Old Testament makes a distinct description of this, that it's not onerous. All interest is onerous. If you lend money, this is from Exodus, if you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a money lender to them. You shall not exact interest from them. And then from Leviticus, if your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner. It doesn't say if your brother becomes poor because they've been good and hit on hard times, nor does it say if your brothers become poor because they are addicted to something, you should ignore them. It doesn't say that. It says if your brother becomes poor, you shall support them as if they were a stranger. You shall not lend them your money with interest, nor give them your food for profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and give you the land of Canaan. And that's one of those things. All of these Old Testament laws are grounded in what God has done. What God has done for the people. And as I've, you know, this series, that's what I've been trying to do, is ground our understanding of the world and how we see these complex issues in the world. Ground it in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Ground it in what God has done for us. That as Christians, we cannot begin to look at the complexities of this world from a neutral space. Or we cannot begin to look at the complexities of the world just in how it affects us, but from what God has done for us. The justice of God is more than the Ten Commandments, but the true love of your neighbor. That is the justice of God, the true love of your neighbor. True justice can only come from God, and our hope rests in God. But we should work. We should work towards this justice. And that's how I want us to see this passage from Luke. This, when Jesus is at the synagogue and he goes up and he reads this quote from the prophet Isaiah, where it says, "Set all your captives free." And it's easy to spiritualize that, right? For that to be about the spiritual captivity to sin. And it is that. It is that too. But that is not the limit of what Jesus is saying. To proclaim release to the prisoners and to liberate the oppressed. When we see what is going on with God, when we read the Bible, we cannot be limited to one interpretation, but realize that God is using multiple ways. God is telling us to be free from captivity to sin, free from captivity to our own self-destructive behavior, but also that we need to proclaim release to prisoners, people in prison. And not just the righteous ones, not just the people who are there because of their innocence, but to everybody. God doesn't make this distinction that we like to make because it makes us feel safe. And I say that to myself as well. Like, this is not, whoa, moralizing Wilson. I make that distinction for what I see and what I do. And that is the challenge of the gospel for me as well for you and for all of us. This does not deny the importance of the state and what they do in bringing order. Romans 13 is really clear in this, in how Christians should acknowledge the authority of the state and the authority of justice. Every person, this is Romans 13, every person should place themselves under the authority of the government. There isn't any authority unless it comes from God, and the authorities that are there have been put in place by God. And yet that is not the limit of what Christians should do. That is not the Christian kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of faith, the kingdom that God is bringing us into, goes beyond the scope of this world. The peace of God is not the peace of society. The shalom of God is not a place where crime is reduced, but where love is found between all people. And that is the challenge, and that is the goal of the Christian life. And it's only possible because of what God has done for us. As Karl Barth says, the mission of the church and every Christian does not deny the mission of the state, but includes and transcends it. In this way, it resists and overcomes the enemy. For the Christian does not recognize them seriously as an enemy. It does not allow him to persist in his hostility to the extent of provoking retaliation. The Christian will refuse to become his enemy, even within the framework of the political order and its necessary fight against disorder. That is the challenge, to love our enemies. And for some of us, you may have direct enemies in your life. It's, I think, fitting the psalm we read, the end of it, where it describes, "For I hear the whispering of many, terror all around, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life." Some of you may experience that. I don't know. But for all of us living in this country, there are enemies that are declared for us, that are designated as such, as enemies, and designated as such in a way that as Christians, we must love them. And that is a challenge and a call. It's not that if you don't do that, you need to do this and this and this to earn salvation. We have grace through the resurrected body of Jesus. But we are called to love our enemies. As Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, "You have heard that it was said, you must love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who harass you." Harass you. That's really concrete, right? If you're feeling harassment, that hurts. It's tender. "So that you will be acting as children of your Father who is in heaven. He makes the sun rise on both the evil and the good and sends the rain on both the righteous and the unrighteous." That's one of my favorite passages. God sends the rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Just because it's raining in your life doesn't mean that you're unrighteous. And just because it's raining in someone else's life doesn't mean that they're unrighteous. Though it's easy for us to look in that direction. I want to speak today about two responses we have to Jesus' call to love our enemies. Fear and forgiveness. Now, forgiveness does not mean an absence of fear. Nor does fear mean an absence of forgiveness. When I talk about fear, I want to mention one incident in my own life. I used to live in Denver, as some of you know, about 10 years ago. And one time I was going home to the Catholic worker house, and a person came up and had a gun and pointed at my face and said, give me your phone and your wallet. And at that time, I was hiking a lot, and so I didn't have a wallet. I had a Ziploc bag, because if you fall in a creek... your wallet gets ruined, but if you fall in a creek with a Ziploc bag, everything is fine. So this person has this gun to my face, and he says, "Give me your phone and your wallet." And at first I'm like, well, I don't actually have a wallet. And then I realize, this person clearly cares much more about my items than I do. I don't need to debate semantics with a man with a gun to my face. And so I gave him and walked home. And it was this strange incident in my life. But I was single, I was male, I was a single white male in a relatively safe city. I was relatively safe at home. I didn't have a lot of stress out of that. I think back to if that had happened to me now, my family had been with me, a completely different response. The threat to my wife and my children is incredibly different than the threat to the person with a Ziploc bag for a wallet. I now have a human wallet. but it's still, and that's, I think that fear is concrete, and we cannot be glib about what Jesus is saying, because Jesus is not glib about this. And it's so easy to be glib. Oh yeah, love your enemies. That's what you should do, but I can't do that. It's so easy to say that. It's so easy to dismiss it. And I think the power of what Jesus is saying is not for those times or for those enemies that are far away, but for the real people who threaten your life. And it's not that you should forgive them or love them because you're amazing people or I'm an amazing person. It's because what God has done for us. Amen. It is only by faith. If Jesus didn't rise from the dead, then yeah, we should expect revenge against our enemies. If God didn't conquer death, then the only justice we have is the justice we mete out ourselves. But as Christians, we claim higher justice. And it's not by saying turn the other cheek, by saying not an eye for an eye, but to love our enemies. It's not saying that we let anything go, but we let go of control over justice. That justice is not in our hands, justice is in God's hands. And we as a people are not called to mete out justice, but to love our enemies, to love our neighbors, to not make the people around us enemies. Fear is real. Fear in these cases is real. We fear being abused. We fear being used. There are a lot of fears in this, but I want to point out one more, you know, uncomfortable reality of this, uncomfortable reality of the algorithms I started with. You know, the funny thing about the white crime index is that most people who commit white collar crimes are white people, and most people in our prisons are not. And most of the crimes that are prosecuted and pursued are crimes that face people of color in this country. Racism is not a pejorative term, it's a descriptive one, a descriptive aspect of the structural issues going on. In a place, in a city where only a few years ago, you couldn't move to a neighborhood if you were African American, you couldn't move to a neighborhood if you were Latino, if you were from a different place. Where only a few years ago, the Chinese Exclusion Act meant that people of Asian descent couldn't move to this country unless they were business owners. In the same place. A few years ago, Alina and I went down to Columbus, Texas. My grandfather grew up near Columbus. There was a lynching in Columbus in 1936, and he remembered it. And so we went down to see it, and we got out, and I was just looking at, and there's the lynching tree right there on the outside of Columbus. And while I was just standing there, a couple of people in the back of their pickup truck drove by screaming N-word lover to me. Just for standing there. I wasn't doing anything. Another thing I realized this week is that in 1882, there was a man named Augustine Aguirre who lived in Oatmansville. Do any of you know where Oatmansville is? It is Oak Hill. It's what originally Oak Hill was called. So Augustine Aguirre was from Mexico, and he was living with his family, and he had a dog. And some people walked by and shot his dog one day for the fun of it. And Augustine was a brave man, was a strong man. He went to the judge and said, "This man shot my dog. I need recompense." And he was granted an order for that. And he was given compensation for the loss of his dog. And so the people who shot his dog got a mob together and came to his house and killed him and his wife. That is a lynching. That is what a lynching is. A lynching is extrajudicial justice outside of due process. And it doesn't have to be a noose. It's the mob taking justice into their own hands. And that happened in Oak Hill. There's no monuments to it, right? I didn't know about it until I looked it up. There are only over 3,000 lynchings have happened in the United States between the Civil War and the 1950s. There are three monuments to them. One in Waco, and one in Minnesota, and I think the other one is in Ohio. Not a lot in the South. That's a lot of people who have been killed outside of the rule of law. When we went to Hungary with Alina, they have these amazing Holocaust memorials. There's this amazing Holocaust memorial in Budapest that's really beautiful and lovely. And I know some of you have been there, and there's one that has the shoes of the children that were taken. And that's a powerful reminder. There are not lynching memorials in the United States. We don't look at that history. We don't stare that history in the face. We ignore it. And when it's brought up, it is often dismissed. And it's hard to talk about. It's a reality of the place we live. It is a stain. It is a stain on the place we live. And we shouldn't. I mean, I don't speak about it because I'm a good person or anything like that, or because I need to want everybody to walk away feeling guilty or sorry for themselves or that, but because the resurrection of Jesus Christ should free us to look honestly at where we are, at the place we are in, and at its history. That we are free to see the brokenness around us because God frees us from our own brokenness in that. that we are free to admit the brokenness, admit the culpability of our society, because God ultimately will free us in that. The point is not whether or not you and I are good people. Jesus did not say, go and be good people. Jesus said, go and love your neighbors, go and love your enemies, and pray for those who persecute you. We are structured to be unsurprised by the color of the skin of the prison population in this state. We're structured to be unsurprised by that, to expect that. We should be offended. We should be ashamed. We should not be silent of this reality. And so retribution, again, is such a temptation to exact revenge. As Jesus says, you have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you that you must not oppose those who want to hurt you. That is hard to hear. It is hard to say. And it can only be said because of who Jesus was and what he did. If people slap you on your right cheek, you must turn the left cheek to them as well. It is easy to make that a metaphor. It is hard to make that a life of discipleship. And so we come to forgiveness. Forgiveness is not about having all the answers. Forgiveness is about believing in God more than we believe in ourselves. That's what it comes down to. Forgiveness is an act of faith. And forgiveness is not simply a good idea. Forgiveness is a concrete need for a Christian who claims Jesus as Lord. We need it. It feeds us. If we do not forgive, it eats away at us. Sin is by definition self-destructive. And if we hold on to our grudges, if we hold on against others, against people in our lives, against people in this world, we are eating away inside of ourselves. Because Jesus did not simply rise in our hearts, but in the flesh. I'm going to read from a book by the theologian James Cone. It's called The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And he wrote it near the end of his career. He's emeritus from Union Theological Seminary. He grew up in Arkansas, and an interesting anecdote for him was that he was often very skeptical of feminist theology, because for him, most white women were people who got black men hanged. And that was the challenge of his coming to address this dark, dark shadow chapter in his own life and in the life of this country. So here's what he says. And yet the Christian gospel is more than a transcendent reality, more than going to heaven when I die to shout salvation as I fly. It is also an imminent reality, a present one, a powerful liberating presence among the poor right now in their midst. The gospel is found wherever poor people struggle for justice, fighting for their right to life, liberty, and happiness. Without concrete signs of divine presence in the lives of the poor, the gospel becomes simply an opiate. Rather than liberating the powerless from humiliation and suffering, the gospel becomes a drug that helps them adjust to this world by looking to the pie and the sky. And so when we respond to the resurrection of Jesus, when we respond to this Easter season, we must be grateful for what God has done for us. We must have faith in the justice, the eternal justice that will come to this world, but we must not rest idly by with the injustices of this world. Not that we are going to save it. Not that we are suddenly the Messiahs. Not that we are suddenly going to have the amazing plan that's going to fix everything. But just like with the environment, just like with immigration, we begin with those around us, with our neighbors. We begin with those people in our life who have harassed us, who have hurt us. And not that they're going to love us back. Not that if you forgive your enemy, they'll stop being your enemy. It's not an efficiency situation. The gospel is not a conflict resolution manual. It'd be great if it was, but it's not. God calls us to be disciples, to pick up our crosses and carry them, because in them there is lightness, there is life, there is joy. And when we avoid it, when we look at it, when we walk away, there is the heaviness of the self-destruction of our own sin eating away at us. As witnesses to the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, Christians have to attest by their life that the fashion of this world passes away, because the kingdom of this world has kingdom of God has drawn near. The Christians have to do this by refusing to conform to this world, asking in opposition to it, what is the will of God? What is the will of God? What is the will of God in those hard places? What is the will of God in those times, those challenges, those times when we don't want to think about it? What should we do? Hopefully you have a little sheet of paper. If you don't, you can use the back of the bulletin that says notes. I want us to take time as we have these past few weeks. What should we do? What should I do in the face of injustice? What should we as a church do in the face of injustice? I had the privilege of, some of you know, of testifying before a House panel this last session for a bill that would have made it illegal for cities like Austin to ban background checks. So the bill was to make so cities couldn't decide what to do in that case. The bill was put very last on the calendar for the House session. So that means it did not come up for debate at all. I have no idea. My testimony probably didn't matter. It felt a lot good to me to be there, to do it, to be a part of the process, that I was able to speak for people in my life in that kind of way. That's, I think, one example of something. The point is not that you do these things to make yourself feel better about yourself or make yourself feel like you're that, but that what God has done for us calls us to look at the world in a different way. And so I want us to take the time to think about how we as a church, how you as individuals can look at the world in a different way, can see, can act, can love, love our neighbors, love our enemies, and refuse to call the people our society claims as enemies, to call them enemies. Refuses to accept that and still honors our risen Lord. Now, let us take this time.